Good afternoon, everyone, and good evening to anybody in our British or European audience. What a pleasure it is to reconnect with Candace Robb, an author that I've read all of her Owen Archer books and actually used them as a guide for touring York, pretending I was in the medieval city and actually booking a room in the B&B in the Bootham Bar Gate so I could lie there and listen to the York Minster bells blast away and think I was really in the 14th century or something. Candace is the author of the Owen Archer series, the very series I am referring to, which A Choir of Crows we have there in the store. And The River Woman's Dragon is coming out sometime this year. When is that, Candace?
At the end of August in the UK and November 2nd in the US and Canada.
Yes. Wonderful. She also writes the Margaret Kerr series as Emma Campion, two novels, and the Kate Clifford series. So Candace has never lost her enthusiasm for medieval mystery, nor have I. Mary Sherritt has built a career writing meticulously, I'm quoting here, meticulously researched, fascinating historical novels about strong women forgotten by time. They include Alma Mahler, Hildegard von Bingen, and Emilia Bassano Lanier, in addition to such novels as The Daughters of the Witching Hill. And today we're going to be talking about two English mystics, Marjorie Kemp, a woman I commend for quitting reproducing after 14 children. She was still alive and that was a hard thing at that time. So a new life, good for her. And Julian of Norwich, about whom I know little, but would love to know more. So Candace, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much, Barbara. It's so exciting. Mary and I have been exchanging emails all week. I don't know about talking about this. She is a woman on a mission to write women back into history, and that's a mission dear to my heart. So it's no wonder that when our mutual agent, Jennifer, introduced us a couple of years ago at a conference, we just hit it off right away. And I was so excited when she asked me to not only read her, I have the galley of the book, but to do an event with her because I have so many questions. And really, I just want to be the big fangirl. But I wanted to say, I came to your work through your 2012 novel, Illuminations, Mary. And I, you know, an anchoress at the age of eight, Hildegard von Bingen has always, that story has always kind of horrified me. And you wrote in the first person. You must have deeply, deeply absorbed that research. You know, I stood amazed because to be that person in the first person, you had to, and now you've done it again with the marvelous revelations. I mean, so can you tell us a little bit about your research? I mean, how it kind of, I have more specific questions later, but I'm real curious about this.
For revelations?
For revelations, yeah.
Yeah. So when I was researching my novel, Daughters of the Witching Hill, I was living in Lancashire, England at the time. And I was doing a postgraduate history course at Lancaster University called Late Medieval Belief and Superstition, kind of to steep myself in the mindset of the time, because that's really important for me. And in that course, we learned about Marjorie Kemp. And we read little selections from the book of Marjorie Kemp. I had never heard about her before. And I was just amazed because she completely exploded my every stereotype about medieval women. I mean, she was not just the mother of 14 children. She was a businesswoman. She had a brewery and a horse-drawn grain mill. And she was fed up. She didn't want to have a child number 15. And the only way she could deal with it was trying to get her husband to make a vow of celibacy, not so successful. And so she had to leave and she couldn't just get a divorce. She had to go on pilgrimage. And her adventures on pilgrimage are unforgettable. I mean, we were reading the excerpt from the book of Marjorie Kemp, where she's riding on her donkey towards Jerusalem. And she suddenly has this blinding religious vision and it's so beautiful. And she's caught up in such raptures and ecstasies that it says in Anthony Bale's translation, and then she fell off her ass, meaning donkey. And I'm going, yes, this is incredible. And I thought I must write a book about her. And yeah, it was a tough sell though, because how do you make a weeping mystic kind of accessible to a modern audience? But I persevered because I think her story is so important and so relevant. And she's just such an exciting, original figure. You couldn't make her up if you tried. She was on trial for her life, accused of heresy. If she was found guilty, she would have burned at the stake. And what does she do? She tells the Archbishop of York an amusing parable about a priest in the woods who meets a defecating bear. I mean, you can't make this up.
That's so amazing. I wanted to mention that one of my favorite Ellis Peters Brother Canfield books, and I cannot recall which one it is, presents that same dilemma. Do you remember, if you read it, do you remember the wife whose husband decided that he would take, it's a slightly different version of it, a vow of celibacy and enter into a monastery, and she was left destitute. She couldn't divorce him. You know, she couldn't do, and it's a really moving story. And one of the ones where you probably sympathize with a murderer more than anything else that she ever wrote. But think about that position. What would happen if your, you know, spout, your husband, it would be, for a man, probably be easier if a woman went into the, you know, to a nunnery. But what would you do in an area with no divorce and no options and no money and no child support and what?
Yeah, it was a big dilemma. What the husband insisted before Marjorie went on pilgrimage, she had a bequest from her father who had recently died, and he said, you can go on pilgrimage, but first you have to pay off my debts. And she did. So she paid off his debt, so he was in a good situation before she absconded for the Near East.
Good for her. Well, probably wasn't as appropriate for a man to take on a mistress and, you know, celibacy with Marjorie, but not necessarily celibacy everywhere. Even a charter with a role reversal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, Candace, carry on.
That's all right. This is fun. This is what we're hoping for. Early in the book, Mary, I was so glad to see you dealing at length with what it meant for a woman to have so many children. Because in my experience, that's seldom dealt with in any account of her life, except as a number, what it meant about her agency and her husband's sense of entitlement. As a novelist, it gives you a base for exploring where she was coming from. It gives you, I think, if I'm imagining how you came up with this right, it gave you a way to show the reality for women in the 15th century and why she was the way she was. Can you talk about that a little bit, how you developed this background and imagined this for her?
Sure. In the book of Marjorie Kemp itself, it says very little about her children, except, as you said, the number. And the only child that's mentioned in detail is her oldest son, and who has several chapters. A, when he's born and she has the horrible postpartum depression, and B, when he's an adult and she visits him and Danzig, which is now Gdansk, Poland, but the other children are just not even mentioned by name. We don't know how many survived because there was a high child mortality, obviously. So that was something that I really had to dig into as a novelist, to humanize her and to humanize her family, because, you know, that's the most controversial thing she did. Even now, we would judge her totally for leaving her children. She even left a new baby because she just had a baby and then decided there's not going to be any more babies and she couldn't trust her husband. And so she left the baby in care of her mother and went on pilgrimage. But we would judge her for that even today because that's a radical thing to do. So I had to really dig into that and show the reality of what was involved in having that many children and the toll it takes on your body and just the physical toll on your spine, on your teeth, and the emotional toll, especially in an age of high infant mortality. If you have that many children and, you know, probably half, you're lucky if half of them survive, and the emotional burden that was, and then of course the care and everything. And yeah, I see her as actually a hands-on mother, not kind of shunting them off. So I think it was a big, big thing for her, and also heartbreaking to leave them, but a necessity.
You really, what I loved is how you make this her tragedy. I mean, it's as much the family's tragedy as hers, because she really has no other choice. She knows that she's not good for the children right now, but it's so beautiful the way you make her so human in this, that we sympathize with her. And then you go with this wonderful, her mission for Julian. I mean, you have this brilliant plot device. You know, I'm thinking of this as a plotter, as a crime writer. That's another great character builder, like what you did with the family, because the dangers she's undertaken, they're amplified by the secreted manuscript, especially once you really unfold. You do a beautiful job of slowly showing the reader the background of religious turmoil, the church's attitude toward women. And Julian is such a figure of respect to many of your readers. So her entrusting the manuscript to Marjorie is a way to ennoble her character. And I just, you know, I know that you've said that, you know, you got this, the germ of this idea from Dr. Janina Ramirez's BBC special. And that was a wonderful documentary. But I went back and looked at it, and it's just a tiny little comment. So you really built on that. And I'd love to hear how you built up that scene.
Well, the encounter between Julian and Marjorie really happened. Uh-huh. It's mentioned in the Book of Marjorie Kemp. And for me, that was the most special point in her story, because she's just left her husband and family to go on pilgrimage, but she still doesn't have any sense of validation. And she even doubts herself, doubts her own visions. What if I'm just doing the wrong thing? So she needs religious counsel from another woman. So she goes to Norfolk and seeks out Julian, who's a famous anchoress. And she just like pours out her soul. And the Book of Marjorie Kemp said they spent several days together in prayer and contemplation. So it wasn't just this quick, you know, 5-minute chat. And Julian really helped her, and she validated her and she supported her. And she said, you know, you have to trust the voice of your own heart, the voice of your divine calling within your own heart. And if some people dislike you and disapprove of you, maybe that means you're doing something right. And go, Julian, it's like medieval sisterhood, whoa. And so given the depth of Julian's support and the rapport they have, I think it's not such a leap to believe that Julian entrusted her manuscript. She was approaching the end of her life. She was 70 and Julian was 40. And her, And her manuscript, Revelations of Divine Love, the first book in English written by a woman, was a highly controversial document. It was a work of theology written by a woman in English at an age where you could be burned for having an English translation of the Bible, where you needed the archdiocese's permission to own a single Bible verse translated into English. And a woman has written a whole book of theology in English about her visions of an unconditionally loving God who she said she could see no wrath, no hell. I mean, that's radical even today. A lot of Christians today would think, you know, that's, you know, they wouldn't accept that. So it was really, really radical. And if you're approaching the end of your life and you're an anchoress and can't leave, what do? You find a sympathetic person to entrust your manuscript with, and Marjorie happened to be going on pilgrimage, and she was in a position to share it with people sympathetic to Julian's message, and also to drop by different monasteries en route so that people could copy it in their scriptoriums. Hi, Diana.
Hi. How are you, Mary?
There, you thank you for joining us.
Right. Yeah. You missed the part where we were having a really interesting discussion. We could go back to it a little bit about what do you do if you are Marjorie Kemp and you have had 14 children and you really don't want a 15th and you've had postpartum depression, and how do you cope with that if you feel like you just can't go on? And how would people feel about you if you abandon your children and forced your husband to take a vow of celibacy, at least with you? So this is a question you've dealt with about people abandoning children in marriages. So what do you think?
Oh, let's see. What'd you do? Well, I suppose going on a pilgrimage would be a really good way of obviating the problem. Possibly she did other things than that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You'd have to have a understanding husband or a good hand with blackmail.
I think, what did you say, Mary, that she actually bribed him by paying off his debts?
Yeah, that was his condition. He said, yeah, she supposedly wasn't allowed to go without his permission. He kept reminding her. But he said, I'll give you my permission if you pay off my debts.
I see. Okay.
And then she hit the road, right?
Yeah.
Which is amazing. So Candace, can you reprise your question about Julian just a little bit to get Diana up to speed?
Oh, okay. So what I was marveling about, since I'm coming from it from a crime writer point of view, and the plotting, I love the plotting that goes behind bringing somebody to life like this. And I thought that her mission, Marjorie's mission for Julian, is such a brilliant plot device and another character builder for Marjorie. I mean, you know, she's dealing with this character that has been so vilified about, oh, you know, she's the hysterical woman and everything. But here you have her entrusted with a secreted manuscript that is so dangerous because it's written by a woman, and there's all this religious turmoil. And Julian is not only encouraging her to go on pilgrimage, she's entrusting her to share this document with people, with women in abbeys and priories all over the country, all over Europe, and on her way to Jerusalem. That's a great plot device. And so I was asking Mary, you know, how she, you know, okay, you've got that idea, and you've got what Marjorie says about she and Julian in the book, but how do you develop it into the scene? And that's what we were talking about when you came in, Diana. By the way, hi, Diana. Oh, I don't think we've met.
I made it. Yeah, so how did you do it?
So Mary, what was your answer?
Sorry?
I said, what was your answer? It's a great question. I know you sort of answered it, but if I remember right from what you said, Marjorie meets Julian fairly early on as she is going.
Yes. On. Yeah, just before she leaves for her pilgrimage, she wants to get validation and spiritual counsel from another woman. So she seeks out Julian in Norwich, which is about 45 miles, slightly less, from Marjorie's home of Bishop's Lynn. And so they, as it said in the Book of Marjorie Kemp, they spent several days together in prayer and contemplation. So it was not just a quick meeting, it was a real kind of meeting of the minds. And I think a strong sense of support for Julian, and then taking it, my plot twist also for Julian to entrust her manuscript with Marjorie.
Yeah, I thought that was great. Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's a great idea.
Can you fill us in a little more?
It looks fascinating. Yeah.
Sorry. Can you fill us in a little more on Julian of Norwich? I mean, is she an anchoress? She's an anchoress.
Yes.
In, right?
Yes. So Julian of Norwich was 30 years older, roughly, than Marjorie. So we know very little about her life before she became an anchoress, but we do know that the plague came to Norwich three times before Julian turned 30. So at the age of 30, It's quite possible that she was married with children and lost her entire family from the plague. So she writes in Revelations of Divine Love that she was around the age of 30, and she must have been in a really down state because she prayed to be brought to the edge of death so she could look beyond the veil and see what lay beyond. And her prayer was answered. So she had this near-death experience. And while having this near-death experience, she had a series of divine visions. And so she literally saw Christ face to face. And what she saw would completely undid everything that she formerly held true. She saw no evidence of divine wrath or hell or anything like that, just unending love. She said she felt he opened his heart and she looked inside and she experienced such overwhelming love, it ravished her heart. And she also referred to God as mother, not just father. So she says, God is our mother. And this word mother is so beautiful and soft and mild. It can't belong to anyone but God, which is radical too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, when you think about it, there were women who were burned for, even in the 14th century, the beginning, Margaret Poiret.
Yeah.
Were saying very much the same thing. And so it's anybody who has, you know, somebody who's steeped in medieval history like I am goes, oh my God, Marjorie, now you've got this.
Yeah.
And it's she's so faithful to protecting it, which is another thing that really helps you bring the ennobling aspects of her out. So that she's no longer, I mean, and talk a little bit about, if you would, about, you know, this whole image of the hysterical woman that she, I think your theory is kind of that she puts this on because that's what gets her, that's how she gets away with a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So that was my thing, how to approach her weeping in a way that, she had this reputation, for those who don't know, she had this reputation as a weeping mystic. So when in the throes of religious ecstasy or bliss, she would just weep and weep and weep. She, according to the Book of Marjorie Kemp, she could empty entire churches. And so when the book was discovered, the book went missing, and it was missing for centuries. And then it was suddenly randomly rediscovered at 1934 at a country house party in Derbyshire when people were looking for ping pong balls. They were going through the closets and found this old medieval manuscript that turned out to be the Book of Marjorie Kemp. So anyway, so it was published, an American feminist medievalist named Hope Emily Allen translated it and identified it as a Book of Marjorie Kemp. And it was published to great acclaim, but the first thing people did, and this is in the 1930s, the golden age of 20th century psychoanalysis, everybody's question is, what is wrong with this woman? She weeps all the time. She's hysterical. She's a schizophrenic. She's epileptic. There were this whole series of theories, what was wrong with her. One male expert thought she was suffering from really bad menopause, which I think is hilarious because, you know, I've been through that myself, and unfortunately I didn't have religious visions as part of it, but never mind. But so the weeping, in the context of her time, you can understand it as effective piety, which was a spiritual path then, that people would visualize the crucifixion or the nativity, and they would empathize so much to feel that they were there and they were experiencing it with the characters they were visualizing. And then they would weep. In my novel, I kind of have it as using the hysterical woman card to get out of trouble. When people would dig a bit deeper, she would just like go off into weeping, and they just, instead of taking her seriously as a heretic or troublemaker, just, oh my God, that awful, loud, noisy woman, get her out of here.
Yeah.
Yeah. good take on it. Considering what you said about, you know, empathy with your religious experiences and so forth, you continue to see that in some cultures, especially Latin cultures in Latin America, Mexico, etc. You know, los penitentes who will march and, you know, flagellate themselves. And there's a great deal of that sort of, which in some instances might be called religious hysteria, or in others, you know, ecstasy, that it's that empathy.
Yeah, I was in a church once in Bulgaria. This affective piety is still practiced a lot in the Eastern Orthodox Church. So I was in an Eastern Orthodox Church, Hagia Sophia in Bulgaria, in Sofia, Bulgaria. And I heard this like loud weeping, like someone was having a breakdown. It was a young man. And my husband and I thought he must be mentally ill. And we were wondering, is anybody going to help him? Because we didn't speak his language. And there were people kind of milling around the church and they saw him, but they didn't interfere. So we thought, you know, he's a lunatic. What's wrong with him? And then just a while later, we heard the most beautiful Orthodox chanting. And it was the same young man. It was all part of his religious devotion, both the weeping and the singing. And that was normal. He wasn't mentally ill. That was his normal way of worshiping. And the people around him thought it was normal.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And the music does emulate. I mean, you can really hear that weeping and the passion, the, you know, the catch in the throat in their music from the Middle Ages all the way till now. I mean, it's a gorgeous part of their music that really lets it stand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So for the benefit of anybody watching this who is not familiar with an anchoress or an anchor, maybe you ought to explain, because, you know, I've once edited a series of books that had stylites in them in 6th century, you know, Justinian's Constantinople, and the idea of somebody standing up on a pillar forever till their legs, you know, atrophied as a religious, you know, devotion was just amazing. But talk to us about anchors and anchoresses.
Okay, so So Julian was an anchorite. So at the age of 30, after her religious visions, she couldn't go back to an ordinary secular life. So she became an anchoress. And first she was she took her vows as a Benedictine nun, but instead of living in a convent as an ordinary nun, she was bricked into a cell at the back of St. Julian's Church in Norwich. So an anchoress or an anchorite is someone who voluntarily chooses to be bricked into a cell built onto the church for the rest of their life. The door is bricked up. There's a barred window looking out so people can talk to them if they need counseling, and a barred window looking into the church so they can follow mass, but there's no door out, and their food is brought to them and their waste is taken away through a hatch. But they're there for life before they undergo becoming an anchor or an anchorite. They undergo the funeral service, the rites of the dead, they get the viaticum, I mean, the whole works. And it was believed that because of the depth of their sacrifice, they were dead to the world, buried with Christ, that their prayers were especially powerful. And Hildegard, as a young woman, was kind of brought into the anchorage with her superior, a girl not very much older than her. But for Hildegard, it was a nightmarish experience. And she got out as soon as she was able to and began to live as an ordinary nun, not like enclosed in this cell for life. But Julian, at the age of 30, at a mature age, she chose this of her own free will. And I think because of the depth of the visions she experienced, she spent the rest of her life unpacking them and writing about them. So she wanted this retreat so nobody could take her off course. And I think that's one of the reasons she wasn't persecuted, despite her controversial writing, was she was literally enclosed in a house of stone. People thought she was probably safe and contained. But then she snuck her manuscript off with this woman, Marjorie, who was not safe or contained, but literally all over the map.
You've got some great scenes once she's on pilgrimage with the donkey scene, of course, and also when she climbs a rock face. Could you talk about some of what you were doing with those adventures?
Oh, you mean crossing the Alps?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, so that was in the Book of Marjorie Kemp. So she's with a group of pilgrims and they all argue and fall out and they kind of thrust her out of the group because they can't stand her anymore in Konstanz, which is in southern Germany, just before the Alps. And in my fictional version, I have it a bit darker than just got fed up with her, but you have to read the book. And anyway, she needed to cross the Alps, so she split ways with her group. And this guy, this solitary man, his name was William in the Book of Marjorie Kemp. I give him another name. So she, all alone as a woman with a solitary male guide, which in the Middle Ages was also kind of risque, a lone woman and a lone man who aren't related, just, you know, crossing the Alps together. But she crossed the Alps to Italy and got to Venice faster than all the other pilgrims that she was traveling with previously, because her guide must have been very good. So, and I used to live in southern Germany, so I went to the Alps every weekend to walk and climb. So I know the mountains fairly well. So that was a really fun part to write, what it would be like to cross the Alps into Italy.
What time of year was that she was doing this crossing? Dead of winter.
Late autumn and winter. So like, yeah, really extreme conditions and stuff. So yeah.
It's just, you know, I don't think that, well, probably very few people read the entire Book of Marjorie Kemp, except for medievalists, or if you're in a class about it. But, you know, when you read this, you think, how is this book not really popular? I mean, with people outside the medieval community, because it's such an adventure.
Yeah.
You know, and then in the Holy Land, I mean, and all of the negotiations they have to do in order to take a ship.
Yeah.
And secure the guides once they go to the Holy Land. And you didn't take a pilgrimage into the Holy Land, did you?
I took lots of pilgrimages for my research. I went to Rome and Santiago de Compostela, not the whole Camino, but part of it. And I went to Our Lady of Walsingham and to Norwich and Canterbury. And I went to Bhutan to explore. That's the closest I could get to like a medieval kingdom with like where monasteries are still very politically powerful and abbots are really like powerful people and you don't mess with them. And monks are very, very respected. And as a woman, you're not allowed to sit next to one in case you might like, your impurities might lead him astray, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I didn't make it to Jerusalem, unfortunately. I wish I had, and maybe I still will one day, but I didn't actually go to Israel.
But your description is just wonderful in the book.
Thank you. That was based, I mentioned the book in my afterword, Nicole Charion was a French writer, and she had all these original quotes from Christian pilgrims traveling to the Holy Land in the Middle Ages, and their lived experiences. And it's just the most fascinating stuff I've ever read. Like this was about a century and a half after the Crusades had finished, after the Muslims had conquered and driven out the Crusaders, but still there were long scars and shadows. So each Christian pilgrim was a possible Crusader. So they had to keep these people contained. So each Christian was a possible terrorist extremist. And so there was all this suspicion But Marjorie really bonded with her Muslim guide because he was far kinder to her than the English pilgrims she was traveling with. And she would go off in her weeping and they'd say, oh God, that woman is such an embarrassment. And then her Muslim guide would take care of her and make sure she was okay. And when all the other English pilgrims, you know, abandoned her, he took her up Mount Temptation and all these places. So he really looked after her. And that's really in the book. So she had profound friendships with people from other faiths. So that was that.
Did she make it back to England?
Yes, she did. But she was gone so long on pilgrimage that when she came back, there were all these rumors that she'd gone abroad to have a bastard child, as if she didn't have enough children already. I'm sure that's like having a 15th child, that's what every woman wants to do in life. But she could have stayed home if she wanted to do that. But anyway, so she had to deal with all these terrible rumors. And she did her whole pilgrimage to Jerusalem and Rome and back and gets home and then all these nasty rumors. And she was healthy and hale and hearty her whole pilgrimage. She's back in Bishop's Lynn at home. And then she suddenly gets dysentery and nearly dies. After traveling to the ends of the earth and not getting ill. And so after recovering from this, she says, sod it, I'm going on pilgrimage. And then she takes off to Santiago de Compostela.
Just fabulous trip. I've been on parts of it. I've been in Rocamadour and walked parts of it in France and then walked part of it to Compostela.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can see it's almost a whole way of life. And what really fascinated me in Santiago is that it was, it attracted, and there still are, a huge settlement of silversmiths, because when tourists, you know, with money, they, there was a reason for the silversmiths to practice their trade there. And the other thing I truly love is that outside the church, there's this huge fountain. And because if you had walked on the Camino, they didn't really want you in the church before you took a bath. So not only dunk you in the fountain, but they have this enormous censer full of incense. And
yeah.
And there is an actual paid position within the cathedral where the man swings the censer. So it was a way of, you know, fumigating the audience in church for the people that would come in from, from these long walks.
Were you in church where they did that, where they had it swinging?
Which I'm sure I shared with Diana. I brought her back an onyx piece because that's kind of a special image thing in Santiago. But yes, we did take a video of the censer, and there's a uniform for this man. And as I said, it's an actual stipend. And strangely enough, in Lausanne, Switzerland, there is a paid position by the city for a man who every night spends it on top of the cathedral in Lausanne, and his job is to be the fire watcher. And it's the only city in Europe probably that has never burned, because this guy, you know, was up there, and it's still a paid position. He is still there every night.
Yes.
Which I find absolutely fascinating. But the other thing you talked about, which I think we may have forgotten, is that the shortest route, if you think about it, from England to the Holy Land was really to go overland and then sail from Venice. Because before the Western Sea Lanes opened, Venice was really the gateway to the Middle East. You know, it's where the Silk Roads came in and all the rest of it. And Venice was this incredibly powerful sea power. And then once the North Atlantic routes and those countries, Spain and Portugal and all opened up, Venice kind of became a backwater, but it was huge at the time that you are talking about.
So Marjorie went via Venice. So she crossed the Alps into Italy and then headed to Venice. And all the pilgrim ships came together in the spring, but they didn't know exactly when. So the pilgrims all wanted to arrive early. And there were only a certain amount of ships, so you had to make sure you got a berth on one of the ships. And the ships weren't always in the greatest repair, and the sailing conditions varied from ship to ship, so you had to make sure you picked the right ship. one with hopefully very few rats on it. And so that was interesting experience, researching all the things that they put up with on the actual voyage in those ships. And they had galley slaves rowing them. And so they lived under horrible conditions. And then they had to eat the pilgrims had to eat this like ship biscuit that was so hard it would break your teeth. So you had to soak it in this the wine that they had on board, which was really bad. And so they finally make it all the way to the coast of Syria, and they're in Jaffa, and they're held kind of to make sure they don't get up to mischief while waiting for all the other pilgrims in. So they finally made it there, and their wine gets taken away because they're not supposed to have wine because they're in a Muslim ruled country. So no wine for you pilgrims.
Candace, did you have other questions that we've short-circuited?
No, I think that we've actually, I guess one that I was going to ask, but it's really up to you whether you want to answer this, is whether your work with Julian and Marjorie and Hildegard has affected your own spiritual practice.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it completely has. I often found myself moved to tears by the sheer beauty of Julian's writing and her description of divine love. It was just, I think anyone of any background can read that book and be inspired by it. But I was also deeply inspired by Marjorie's experience of doubt, because her doubt made her so human, and who doesn't feel doubt? And the way she kind of walked through her doubt to the other side, to the sense of belonging and purpose, and that was deeply inspiring to me. One of the medieval texts that I read for the background on this was The Cloud of Unknowing by an anonymous mystic. And that's one of the most beautiful books about spirituality I've ever read. Like, to really come to that place of true kind of union with the divine, however you perceive the divine, you have to kind of leave all your preconceived notions about what you think God is, and all your doubts come together, and the dark night of the soul and everything, and you just keep walking through and surrendering all, you know, your expectations, and then finally you come to that beautiful still place, this kind of dark cloud of mystery that is the divine. And I thought that was really, really inspiring.
Yeah, that's
it. Do you have questions? You missed the beginning of it on purpose. My request, actually.
It's not a spiritual question at all. more pragmatic. Where did Marjorie get the money to pay her husband's debt?
Oh, her father was the mayor of Lynn, and he was quite a wealthy man. He was a mayor. He was head of the Guild of the Holy Trinity. He was a merchant. He was a member of parliament. So he had a fair bit of money. And he died and left her this bequest to go to Jerusalem to pray for his immortal soul. So thanks, Dad.
So she was part of that to finance her getaway.
Yeah. And when she was in really deep trouble, she would say, "I am the mayor of Lynn's daughter," and kind of pulling that clout, because that got her out of lots of trouble.
She's also a really successful businesswoman.
Yes. Yeah, she was a very successful businesswoman in her own right. One of the historians I was in conversation with on What's Her Name? Women's History Podcast, Olivia Nickel, had the theory that Marjorie herself was a merchant, and that she was secretly engaged in trade during her whole pilgrimage, and bringing lots of stuff back from her journeys and selling it on, although it doesn't say so. But that might be an interesting way of how she could have financed her pilgrimages.
Yeah, that would
be a natural-born businesswoman. This is the way your mind would work, you know?
Yeah.
Why would you pass up opportunities if you're going to an exotic land? Plainly, you could do something with this.
Very fact that she was able to write a book really argues for her being, you know, from a richer and higher class family, because I mean, you know, the fact she's even literate is a real achievement. And when is this book? It starts in
1436 to 1438, it was written. She didn't write it herself. She dictated it orally to a priest who wrote it down for her. So she dictated it. And because a priest took her dictation, that gave gravitas to her narrative and so forth. There are various theories. She claimed to be an unlettered woman. And some people interpret that as saying that she was illiterate herself. But there are other academics who say, as a woman of such high social class, it's highly unlikely that she was illiterate in English, but she was probably not fluent in Latin. So you were only truly literate if you could read and write in Latin, which was the preserve of scholars and clerics. So, and then if you were a woman who could read, you were a lot in more danger of being accused of heresy. And so if you were being accused of heresy, it was really convenient to say, oh, I'm a poor unlettered woman, I can't read, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you'd be more likely to be declared innocent.
We have a question from author Patricia Bracewell. Hi, Patricia, it's nice to hear from you.
Hi, Patricia.
And her question is, Mary, why did you think it was important to write Revelations in the first person as opposed to choosing the third?
Okay, so the Book of Marjorie Kemp, although it's an autobiography, is not in the first person. It's in the third person. And it doesn't even say Marjorie did this, Marjorie did that. It refers to her as this creature. So it's like completely self-effacing. This creature did that. Everyone was so annoyed with this creature that they threw her out of their pilgrimage party and said, we don't want to eat with you anymore. All you do is ruin our wine drinking with your stupid tears. And the creature was very dejected and blah, blah, blah. And so I wanted to give her her own voice, to tell her story in her own voice, because I thought that would be kind of fun to peel back the whole kind of this creature veil and see the real Marjorie underneath.
So Diana, Claire has some of the same issues, doesn't she? When she suddenly appears having traveled down through the stone and she suddenly pops into Scotland. I mean, you know, she has a tremendous amount of explaining to do to people who just don't want to believe her.
Well, you know, it's a very classic sort of story, you know, both the quest story, but also a fish out of water story. Having someone who arrives suddenly in a place where they don't know anyone, they're not familiar with how things work. Yeah, this is you see that over and over again. But it's a very, it's full of conflict, of course. And it's also a really good vehicle for explaining historical times to people who know nothing about them to start with, because they learn along with your narrator. You know, they're saying, well, or am I going to find something to eat? While she's thinking, where am I going to find something to eat? And then she figures it out. And then they're like, oh, of course. And so they end up, you know, learning things without you having to sit them down and explain things or put in, you know, a lot of author's notes. I do that anyway. But, you know, without having to, you know, do a lot of setup, et cetera. You know, the one of the basic tenets of good storytelling is don't tell the reader anything until they need to know it. In other words, you know, don't spend pages and pages setting things up or providing all this information that someone should have before they start reading your book. No, you start where that person started, where your narrator starts. And, you know, in medias res, always my husband is looking at things and saying, oh, in medias res, you know, in the middle of this. So it's just a really good way of immersing the reader into not only the story, but into the setting as well, without, you know, making a song and dance about it. So that was really good of you.
Have you done a deep enough dive back into medieval Scotland to know whether there were anchors and anchorites or people that, you know, went on pilgrimage? Or, I mean, we're talking Norfolk, which is north, but it's not over the border.
Yeah, well, you know, Scotland was a Catholic country up until the mid-18th century and so forth. And even though there was quite a rise of Protestantism, you know, from the mid-16th century on, still, yes, back in medieval times, you definitely would have found things like anchorites and so forth. And if you go look at old churches and so forth, sometimes you will see the remains of an anchorite cell if they haven't restored that church to such a degree that they erased it. And one interesting thing I wanted to mention to you, my daughter married a Scotsman, he's half Spanish, half Scottish, and they held the wedding on the Isle of Bute, which is, you know, like 60 miles off Glasgow. But they had the local priest to say do the marriage service for them. I was talking to him at the reception afterward, and he remarked that he had just come back from visiting a hermit. And I said, there are still hermits? And he said, oh, yes. He said, I have three that I visit regularly, you know, to check on their welfare, you know, hear their confession and counsel them and, you know, make sure that they're in good shape. And I was saying, well, how does that work? And so forth. And he said, well, there are modern hermits.
And, it's, you know, an ancient Celtic tradition, isn't it? And it's still, the artist that narrated my audiobook, her name is Polly Lee, but she's the daughter of Sarah Maitland, the author, who is also a modern day hermit and mystic. So she wrote a book called Silence or On Silence. I have it on my bookshelf somewhere, but she lives off in the boondocks somewhere in Scotland, off on her own, and she's just a hermit, and she's very spiritual, and she lives in silence. And she was talking about if you live in silence alone, suddenly you hear things, like she could hear whole choirs, because it's amazing, because we don't even know what silence sounds like anymore. We're so surrounded by noise and screens. And so it's just kind of funky to think somewhere off in the wilds of Scotland, there are hermits.
No. Well, the wilds of Scotland would be very conducive to being a hermit.
Yes.
I asked you the question about anchors and anchorites because the climate, it seems to me, would be against you being walled up outside a church in the north of Scotland. How long could you possibly survive? So they must have given them, you know, they must have given them fire. If you go to Ireland outside Ashford Castle, there's a lovely little village called Cong, and there's the ruins of a fisherman's shack, Ho Ho, which is a little medieval stone building where the fishermen, you know, would hang out and fish in the River Cong. But there is a small fireplace there, almost like a Pueblo fireplace in Santa Fe. And I thought, okay, you know, if you're in Western Ireland and whatever, you wouldn't make it if you didn't have some form of heat. So surely, you know, the anchors.
Oh, they had fires for cooking and heating, I'm sure. And Julian is a patron saint of cats, or the unofficial patron saint of cats, because it's a tradition that anchoresses had cats, because these anchorages, like the her one, was very close to the river. And if you didn't have a cat, you would be overrun by rats. So you want to have a cat with you in your anchorage. And then there's a whole thing in the Middle Ages, how cats are evil and they're the creature of Satan, blah, blah, blah. But I'm sure every anchoress had her very special kitty.
Sure.
Uh-huh. I love that. So Candace, let's go to Owen Archer for a minute, because I really love your series set in medieval York. And as I say, I've actually wandered around medieval York reading your books as guidebooks. How much more time? I mean, this is 1430 something. When is Owen? He's still in the 15th century, isn't he?
He's in the 14th century. He's
before.
Yeah, he's before this. My Kate Clifford series was at the beginning of the 14th century, so she was a little closer. And actually, if I had kept up with the series, Marjorie was going to figure into it with Kate's mother, who had kind of brought the idea of Beguines back to York. But Owen is in 1376 in what I'm working on right now.
So he's heavily engaged in church politics, and in fact he works for the Archbishop. The church has an outside influence in Owen's life.
Yes. Yes, he worked for the Archbishop until the end of the 10th book. And now he's actually the new Archbishop is kind of his nemesis, because it's Alexander Neville, who's he's one of those characters in history that you research and you try to find something good about him so that he doesn't sound like this you know, vaudevillian evil guy, Snidely Whiplash, but no one ever has anything good to say about Alexander Neville, not even his family. I mean, his family knew that the only reason he was the Archbishop of York was because of their influence. Mm-hmm. And they could not control him. And he has a bad end, which is kind of fun to imagine. But yeah, so in my books, the church is very often kind of at odds with the characters that are the prominent characters in my book. But I also have their whole lives are just imbued with the faith and with their knowledge of their belief that God is watching them and that they need to be good people. And you have to have that in your mind all the time when you're writing about the Middle Ages. It's just a part. It's why the Lollard idea in the time that Mary's writing about and in the time I'm writing about is beginning. It's so important politically, because this is just the heart of their lives is the church. And so I can never get away from it. I mean, in A Choir of Crows is Benedictine nuns. That book is about a nun who has, against her will, been taken out of the priory and doesn't believe she'll ever be able to go back. Who's gonna believe her?
Here's Patrick. I was just about to start you up and see whether you had any comments or questions besides Patricia Bracewell's, which was a great question.
It's a great question. Hey, Diana. yeah, actually, I have a couple questions. One for everybody on the panel. Have you guys by chance read that wonderful book by Ron Hansen called Mariette in Ecstasy?
Oh, long time ago. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, wow. I just bring it up because it's on a similar theme and subject, you know, about the young nun who develops the stigmata, and just an incredible book. Let's see here. Yeah, Jean, I think is her name. Jean V, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. She just is asking Candace, you just started speaking on this subject, but she says, you've also explored religious women who have pursued alternative directions than typical nuns like Mary, correct? That's a question from her.
Yes, that's the Beguines in the Kate Clifford series. That they were more of a lay group, but they were lay women, but they took vows. And so they didn't have to have dowries. This is something that developed in what they call the Low Countries. It was very big in Belgium and Germany, and still is today. But they were women who took vows and devoted themselves to the community. So they could have jobs, they made money because they supported themselves, but they lived in community. And somebody like Marjorie Kemp would have just fit right in with them.
The last Beguine died in Kortrijk, Belgium, I believe in 2014.
Wow.
There's a question of whether she actually is the last Beguine, but yeah.
Tell us. No, there are more.
A woman that I was working with while I was working on the Kate Clifford books, a historian said that it's kind of what your definition of a Beguine is that may be a question, because they may not be living in community anymore, but they are still working using those vows and that way of life to work together in their own communities. So I thought that was beautiful.
I think we need a new Beguine movement.
I was going to say the last Beguine. That's a great title, isn't it?
Yeah.
I do have a question, Patty, and I'm actually interested in this too. Mary, can you repeat the name of that book you referred to about silence and the woman living in Scotland? And
Sarah Maitland, M-A-I-T-L-A-N-D. I'm just gonna see if I have her book here. Sorry, I don't see it, but the book is Silence, or it has silence in the title.
It's so Sarah, it's about Maitland?
Yeah. Sarah Maitland, yeah.
She might be in our inventory, Patrick.
I think so too. I'll look it up.
Yeah. So Silence is definitely in the title if it's not the title by itself, but it's fascinating, and it's her true story. So pretty cool.
Let's end this by asking each of you what you're working on. Dana, you can come last. I'm not sure I want to even do that. Candace, what's the title of your new book, and is it an Owen Archer?
Well, the one that is coming out this year is The River Woman's Dragon. So it's an Owen Archer, and it's about Magda Digby, who is the healer and a pagan in the Owen Archer series. And unfortunately, I had promised to write this book just as the pandemic hit, and it's a plague book. It begins in a plague summer in York, so I have lived with pandemics, both writing and, but it people have asked for sort of an origin story of Magda Digby, because she fascinates me, she fascinates everybody, this elderly woman who's so wise. And so this has a lot of origin story in it, but it's still also a cracking mystery. And that comes out at the end of August and in the UK, and November here in the US.
Right, order it early, because sometimes these books disappear. So if I were you, I'd order it in September. If you're an Owen Archer fan, we'll be glad to do that for you. Mary, what are you working on now? I mean, this has just come out, but with most authors, you already moved on.
Yeah, my new work in progress, it's still in its embryonic stage, so I'm a little hesitant to talk about it, but I just wish to introduce you to Ophelia, the feminist plague rat. Just as we got on the topic of plague and pandemic, she's from the Globe in London. So yeah, they had plague rats there. So
I love it. That is absolutely wonderful. And Diana, what's new from you?
Ooh, let me see.
Go tell the bees that I'm gone.
I'm gone.
At the actual yellow page?
That is one of the tip sheets from Century.
Oh, got it.
Oh.
Yes, it is a title page from the UK edition.
Beautiful.
Wow. So basically what I'm actually doing, you know, in terms of, you know, like real work as opposed to signing my name 10 million times, is we're in the production phase of Bees, which means exchanging chunks of the manuscript between me and my US editor. The UK editor has already read it and given me her comments. And so then I sent her a chunk that I have, you know, gone through and done my slash and burn and tidied up and put in all the holes that I can. And she reads it and gives me all her marginal comments coming back. And I, you know, go through and either take her suggestions, or I don't take her suggestions but do something else. I say, no, I'm just not going to do that, or whatever. And then we go on to the next batch. And so we're creating these overlapping pieces at the moment. And meanwhile, I'm reading along in the later parts, which have models. So anyway, it's a very, it's not nearly as much work as the actual final frenzy of writing the thing, but it's still work. And so you know, I spend three or four hours a day doing that, and another couple of hours signing things. And that's pretty much what I'm doing.
Do you ever get sort of fed up with the whole project at some point when you're living with it all the time?
Oh, no, because I can see it, you know, getting closer and closer to being a real book. And that's very exciting. And also, you know, it's fun because it's written, you know, the great effort is done. I know, but going back through it, I can see places where, yes, that would be a really good idea if I know a little bit about this. And in fact, I told my husband, you know, that Jennifer had asked me, could I, you know, put in a little bit more attention in these two specific places. And I said, yeah, of course, nothing to that. And so we mean, there's nothing to that. And I said, nothing to that. You know, it's a really easy thing to do. He said, how would you do that? I said, oh, that's easy. You know, hires a healer, you know, somebody comes staggering in or is dragged in, you know, having been brutalized by, you know, a roving gang of Tory loyalists, you know, and who dies in the front hall or whatever. But, you know, then who did it? And, you know, are they still around? So on.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because so often readers think that the book they get, you know, is the book that you wrote, and they don't recognize all the additional layers of things that go into it before it finally reappears. So I will mention that there's also a 25th anniversary edition of Drums of Autumn coming out on November 2nd, whereas Bees is coming out on November 23rd. And Diana and I have agreed to do a book for a launch party, excuse me, for Susanna Kersley, who writes wonderful, I think, books that have also got time travel in them, or often two different periods. And going back before we quit to, you know, what we were talking about people arriving in places, my very favorite book by Susanna is set in the north of England, where one of the Roman legions, I think it's the 9th, actually disappeared, and nobody has ever quite worked out what happened to them. But there's a Roman legionnaire who appears to the modern Brits. And the part I love the most is that nobody can speak to him because he only speaks Latin, and they don't speak except this kid who's studying Latin in school. So he becomes, you know, the interpreter and the gateway. And I love the fact that the Roman legionnaire didn't magically speak modern English when he showed up. Because, you know, I always think that's cheating when that happens, you know, but I love, so this little kid becomes pivotal, the Latin scholar. What's it called? The something horses.
Shadowy.
Thank you, Patrick. I bring this up all the time so Patrick can remember. The shadowy horses. If you're interested in, you know, and how to blend two different times and cultures and all while you're waiting for Bees, I could recommend The Shadowy Horses.
It's a great story. I have a real nice comment that just came in, might be a fitting way to end, which is from Stephanie. And she says, Mary, Sharon Penman gifted me your book about Hildegard von Bingen for Christmas right after you published it.
Oh,
that's nice.
That's beautiful. Miss Sharon. I wrote to, not you, Diana, but to Candace and Mary before while we were arranging this, and said, you know, how much we miss Sharon and how happy I was actually able to publish her last book a year ago, a little more than a year ago, before she died. And, you know, that's wonderful to be able to complete your work. We all really miss her. She was magnificent. Thank you, ladies. It's been terrific.
Thank you.
Lovely to meet you, Mary. Good luck with the book. It sounds great.
Thank you. We've met at the Historical Novel Society conference many times, but you met so many people. I remember you. I shook your hand. Thank you for joining us. It was lovely.
Perfect. Yeah,
it
was fun.
Zoom is, we can all get together despite our different locations. It is an amazing thing. So anyway, thanks everybody. Enjoy the rest of your day, and don't forget that we have copies of Mary's book at the Poison Pen, and also Candace's book, and soon we'll have Diana's book. So November's gonna be a magical month, right? Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Candace. Thank you, Diana.
Good to see everyone.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.